The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Will we in time? Let's please turn this ship around. This ship with the dinosaurs on board. We've got to get that out of the way. Throw them overboard, please. And let's get to solving this mother of all environmental challenges. I'm talking, of course, about climate change. And to find out a little bit more, get a little deeper insight as to why we are seeing such resistance, and I'm not really focusing on the people who would actively stop progress by denying scientific reality, talking about, you know, just mainstream Americans. Why are we not seeing more concern, more sense of urgency, more action across America? There is some encouraging polling, but it's still just not enough. And we're going to find out more about that, the psychology, the sociology behind this resistance, from someone who I've wanted to have on the show for some time. Very pleased to have Edward May back with me now. He is a distinguished university professor at George Mason University, and they have a wonderful Center for Climate Change Communication, one of my favorite subjects, communicating climate change so that people really understand what's at stake and what we can do about it. Ed has over 25 years of experience as a public health communication and social marketing researcher and practitioner, his research currently focusing exclusively on public engagement in climate change mitigation and adaptation. And there is so much to talk about that I will waste no more time in the introduction and get right to welcoming you, Ed, to the Green Front.
Thank you, Betsy. Nice to be with you.
I heard you speak at the Climate Change Behavior Conference, I think it was about a year ago in Sacramento. You must be having another one coming up.
The Behavior, Energy, and Climate Change Conference. Yes, it's coming to Washington, D.C. this year.
Oh, okay. I probably won't get back there, but you were one of a number of speakers that I just found fascinating in terms of really, you know, looking at statistics, research, you know, graphs of, you know, polling Americans' views on climate change and level of concern and what they think is the cause, and also, you know, what kinds of actions are being taken, what's not happening. And there's been a lot of great research coming out of George Mason University as well as Yale. So one of the interesting reports I'd like to start with is the look at Six Americas, as it's called, and tell us about that. What is meant by that? Who are the six groups of Americans as it relates to climate change understanding?
Great question, and as any communication expert will tell you, there is no such thing as the general public. You know, if we're trying to do a better job of sharing what we know about the changing global climate, it helps a lot to understand who are the distinct groups within our larger population. So as you said a moment ago, my colleague Tony Leiserwitz and Connie Rosa Renouf and I at Yale and George Mason, we've been doing nationally representative surveys of the American adult population and looking for patterns of similarities, commonalities among people's responses. What we found is that there are six distinct views about global warming, and we, as a result, we've called we've called those groups Global Warming Six Americas.
Interesting that you're calling it global warming, just to interrupt for a moment, since mostly climate change is being used. Is that intentional, or are they interchangeable in your view?
So when we started this research in 2008, we felt that global warming was a term that the public understood better than they do climate change. There's some interesting research, including some of our own since then, about the different ways in which people understand the terms global warming and climate change. Global warming is a term that for better or for worse, has taken on more political connotations. People who are strong, who are convinced, strongly convinced that global warming is a problem and are strong advocates for a national response, they actually prefer the term global warming because for them it's a more concrete and a more emotionally resonant term. Conversely, people who aren't yet convinced that the climate is changing, they prefer the term climate change because for them it's a more abstract term, a term that isn't sort of laden with emotional meaning, not the kind of term they hear Al Gore, for example, talking about when they feel that global warming and Al Gore war are almost synonyms in their book.
And, of course, when the snow starts piling up on the East Coast, Fox News says, global warming, what global warming? And, yes, go right into attacking Al Gore. So it is a bit of a misnomer for those who don't fully comprehend how climate change includes extreme weather of all kinds, as we've seen certainly with droughts, fires, floods, record snow, record rainfall. Some of that is selective ignorance and some of that is intentional, but I won't digress too much there, but just thanks for pausing to just because terminology is important, and I think it's more like climate, you know, chaos, climate extremes right now, but there's been some talk about trying to come up with one term, but perhaps that's not really the most important thing. So continue with your look at six Americas.
So what we found from these global warming six Americas is that they fall on a single continuum from a group of Americans that we call the alarmed. They're about 12% of Americans currently. They've got very strong beliefs that the climate is changing. They're very concerned about it. They're extremely motivated to personally take action to deal with it and extremely motivated to see our nation respond to it. The continuum ranges all the way to 10% of the population that we call the dismissive on the opposite side of this span. As might be implied by their name, dismissive, they don't believe that global warming is real. They're not concerned about it. They're certainly not motivated to take personal action or see our nation take action. As a matter of fact, they're rather motivated to fight any sort of attempt to put in place national climate legislation.
And why do you think that is? I mean, what do you think is behind the psychology of just the dismissives? I know that it can cut across anything, like I said, from selective ignorance to just really not being educated on the issues. But I find that many of the people who don't think there's a problem refuse to educate themselves. In other words, they would never see Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, or, you know, even read something or watch something less political, since Al Gore is, you know, certainly a political personality and figure. So I don't know. It just strikes me as strange that people who are so adamant and so arrogant, many of them, you know, on television, Fox News in particular, you know, without, you know, doing any of the research, and somehow they know more than 98% of the world's climate scientists.
This is a tricky issue, but it is not actually one of selective ignorance. My colleague Tony Lizerowitz at Yale and some of his other colleagues did a survey last summer, a climate literacy survey. So they ask a whole broad series of questions about actual factual content about related to climate change, I believe 80 or 81 questions in total. And then they scored, essentially created report cards, if you will, scorecards for each of the six Americas. And what they found pretty remarkably is that the dismissive segment, the segment that is on the one extreme of the continuum, they're not really less knowledgeable in many ways than our members of the alarmed segment. They tend to, on some measures, they actually are more knowledgeable. So it's not so much a matter of their unwillingness to process information. It's just that they are processing different information. They have different trusted sources of information that they're paying attention to. So while people in the alarmed segment pay a lot of attention to what climate scientists say, people in the dismissive segment pay much more attention to alternative voices in the media and in the public dialogue.
But they probably are not scientists, those alternative voices, for the most part.
Well, there are a small number of scientists who are climate skeptics, who are unconvinced that the climate is changing or don't believe that it's being driven by human causes. You referred earlier to the fact that 97%, there's a couple of different research studies that have shown that about 97% of the world's climate scientists are convinced by the evidence that the planet is warming and that human activities are principally to blame. But that still does mean there are 3% out there, 2 or 3%, who aren't convinced. And motivated audiences who would prefer not to believe that the climate is changing are, of course, it makes perfect sense that they're going to pay a lot of attention to that 3%, figuring that they are the ones who have it right.
Well, those 3% sometimes have some ties to oil money, is my understanding. If not the actual scientists, then think tanks that they may have been associated with. I'm not saying all of them, but certainly some of them, if you follow, you know, the trail, if you will.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's, I guess, how do you, though, justify, you know, dismissing 97% of, you know, climate scientists, experts in their field? Just kind of blows my mind, the psychology and sociology of that. You know, that people say, as an example, you know, if you had 97 or 98% of doctors agreeing on your condition, would you go with their advice or the 3% who may have ulterior motives? Maybe they want to sell you some, you know, medicine or equipment that wouldn't necessarily be in your best interest.
Yeah, I think that's a really useful analogy, actually, and it's one that I find people immediately understand the relevance of it. I tell it, I use the analogy in a slightly different way. I say that if your child were seriously ill, and 97% of the top pediatricians in your community said, look, this is, you know, we understand the problem, we feel strongly that you've got to put your child into treatment immediately, you don't have any time to waste. Whereas 3% are saying, well, we're not entirely sure the diagnosis is correct, and even if it is, we think it might be more prudent to wait. I think most parents, I'm pretty sure most parents would say, I'm going with the 97%. But let me add one more perspective on top of this, and that is, in our research, we have asked people quite directly if what they think about what scientists think, if you will, about global warming. Are scientists largely in agreement that the climate is changing? Is there a lot of disagreement among scientists, or are they largely in agreement that the climate isn't changing? And this is perhaps the single most unsettling fact that we've uncovered in our research, and that fact is that about 2 out of 3 Americans erroneously believe that there's a lot of disagreement among the scientists about climate change. So we've already said that, in fact, in reality, 97% are convinced by the evidence, yet two-thirds of Americans think that that's not true, that they feel that there's a lot of disagreement among the experts. And if you think about that, Betsy, it makes perfect sense that if I'm Joe Sixpack and I think that the experts are still duking it out, I'm probably not going to invest a lot of my own personal time, whether that's, you know, intellectual time or emotional time, worrying about an issue that I think the scientists are still fighting over.
Less serious issue, just quick, maybe this is a bad comparison, but, you know, for years I covered, you know, the garbage beat. You know, I had a feature called Trash Talk, just looking at solid waste till it grew from garbage to global warming. And people would use any excuse to say, you know, they don't have to recycle. Well, I hear that they really don't recycle. I hear that, you know, it's just going off, being shipped to China, so therefore I'm not going to recycle. It's like some people will just look for the smallest excuse to absolve themselves of any responsibility.
Yeah. And we actually looked at that. We have a paper right now that is under review at a journal, and we've tried to disentangle sort of the order of the thoughts. Which of these thoughts are more basic? If I really don't believe the problem is true, am I likely to tell myself the story that, well, the experts are largely, you know, still fighting it out amongst themselves? Or is that latter thought, the experts are fighting it out amongst themselves, influencing people's belief that this is a real and serious problem? It turns out it is the latter. So we think this is a misperception, a widely held misperception that really ought to be dealt with by members of the scientific community. They are, after all, the experts. They are the ones who are collecting the evidence that has convinced them that the climate is changing and it's primarily due to human causes. Yet there's this huge, widely held misperception about what they believe. So we think it's pretty important for the climate science community to step forward and try to disabuse the public of this misperception.
Well, and let's not be around the bush here on Fox News, Fox Television, it's hard to call them Fox News, because they are, you know, actively, loudly dismissing science. And I think that's outrageous. I know I'm not alone in that, especially since, you know, Rupert Murdoch, they just had the Emmys on Sunday, as Joe Rome had on climateprogress.org today, talking about how they're greening the Emmys. Meantime, you know, the company that owns them is actively trying to confuse people, question, you know, climate science, and mock people like myself. I'm sure you, if you have been on or would go on, you know, saying we're just a bunch of nuts and, you know, going off on a direction calling Van Jones a communist rather than, you know, most recently I was on because they wanted to talk about how only 41% of people in the world are concerned about climate science, therefore it's a minority, can't be a real problem. And I wanted to say that's because too many of them are watching your show and shows like this. Instead, they went off, you know, in another direction and started yelling and screaming. That's what they do. We know this. But how outrageous is it? Just, I guess I'm asking you maybe on a personal level. I don't know if you have children, but I just can't help but get so angry that this continues. They continue to get away with it, and they're harming progress. They're harming the future generations, and they're laughing all the way to the bank. And yes, media is my area of, you know, interest and passion and expertise. But how big a role do you think this has? I mean, let's just say, imagine for a moment if we didn't have that factor, you know, turning back the tide of public opinion and information and facts getting out there. Where would we be in a different place in terms of talking about this and beginning to address the gigantic challenge we face?
So we would be in a different place, absolutely, yes. We know that because the polls that have been conducted among what Americans know about climate change since for the past 15 years, pre-Kyoto Protocol, so when Al Gore flew off on our behalf to negotiate the Kyoto Treaty, Republicans and Democrats, about two-thirds of each, 65% of both Democrats and Republicans believe that the climate change was real, and they tended to believe it was a serious problem. And yet, in the intervening 15 or so years, we've seen an entirely different evolution of what that issue means to Democrats and Republicans. So an increasing number of Democrats, almost all now, over the past 15 years have become convinced this is a real and a serious problem, and they feel it ought to be addressed. Conversely, the trend line has gone in exactly the opposite direction among Republicans. A decreasing proportion of Republicans believe the problem is real and serious.
Now there's the Tea Party.
that actually comes into some research that we've just done recently, which is trying to get past, trying to understand the question of, who are the Republicans who do still understand that the climate is changing and feel this is a serious problem? And so very recently we conducted an analysis and released a report that pulled people who affiliate with the Tea Party we pulled them into a category unto themselves, and we compared them, Tea Party affiliates, with other Republicans who don't affiliate with the Tea Party, and we compared them both to independents and to Democrats. And what we found is really pretty stark, and that is that Republicans are not nearly as extreme on the issue of climate change as we had previously believed. It's really members of the Tea Party who are quite extreme. They are vastly more likely not to believe the climate is changing, vastly more likely not to see this as a serious problem, and vastly more opposed to really taking any sort of systematic societal efforts to address the problem.
And so what about that larger group in the middle, Ed? How can they best be reached, those who could be convinced if they, you know, were just influenced by the right sources? And what would those, do you go as far as looking at how to remedy this? I mean, actual, you know, science getting out there to actual Americans.
Yeah, so let me take one step back and say I haven't really introduced you to you and your listeners to the groups in the middle yet, but we in the groups, meaning that the Global Warming Six America. So we've talked about the alarmed and the dismissive. They form the two ends of the continuum, and then in the middle of the continuum we've got four groups who are much less engaged in the issue. One of those we call next to the alarmed is a group, a very large group that we call the concerned. They're currently 27% of the public. They understand the climate is changing. They're worried about it, but they don't really see it as their problem, their issue. So they're not really very engaged personally in pursuing solutions, either through their own actions or through societal actions. Next to them, right in the middle of the continuum, is another large group. We call them the cautious, 25% of the population currently. They, too, are inclined to believe that the climate is changing and it's a problem, but they don't feel very certain of those beliefs. So they are characterized, I think, very nicely by what I said earlier. The vast majority of them believe the climate experts are still duking it out, and so they're staying on the sidelines until they hear a definitive answer.
Will there ever be a definitive answer any more so than 97, 98% of experts in their field?
Well, but the, So the answer to that is no, but the public doesn't know that a definitive answer has been reached. The public has heard quite the opposite, that you know, he said, she said. So, you know, one climate scientist says it's true and another climate scientist says it isn't. And it is this he said, she said sort of reporting, which was very common in American media, really until sort of the mid part of this last decade. And that kind of reporting, what reporters might consider fair and balanced reporting, has an enormously corrosive effect in terms of convincing people that the experts are still largely in disagreement, when in fact the experts are vastly in agreement.
Yeah, I hear the issue dismissed as, well, it's political. You know, well, it shouldn't be political. It's gotten politicized. It's gotten polarized, but that's what's so outrageous. And so then people think they don't have to believe anything because it's just a political issue, not an actual real scientific and, huge challenge that impacts everyone and that has, you know, unknown repercussions and impacts since we're in uncharted territory.
That's right. So I sort of lost my train of thought a moment ago.
Sorry.
Let me finish that thought, which was to say that you asked me the question, Betsy, what can we do about the folks in the middle of the continuum, the middle of the global warming six America continuum, to help them better understand the issue?
Yes.
And my answer to that question is we need to stop we need to find ways of making this issue real for them, making it more concrete than we have been doing. Global climate change is, in my opinion, the ultimate abstraction. It is an argument made by scientists using abstract statistical and scientific concepts. It doesn't have any direct manifestation in my daily life, at least none that I am aware of, because telling me the way it is manifesting in statistical terms, or even in concrete terms that aren't part of my daily life. So, for example, the melting of the Himalayan glaciers. It leaves me, I'm using myself as the prototypical American, it leaves me not really understanding why is this relevant to me. So we believe that the way to engage the broad cross-section of Americans who do tend to believe this is a problem, but feel it's a very distant problem. It's distant in both time and in space. So it's not happening here, and it's not happening now. But we, in fact, know that it is happening here and now.
Do they not watch the Weather Channel? Do they not watch the news? Do they not hear anybody connecting the dots between our extreme weather events and likely climate change? I mean, what you're saying, I know, you know, we've heard for years, but there's this thing called, you know, nature screaming out. And a year ago I was pointing to examples of drought and fire in Russia and epic flooding in Pakistan, but we need not look any further than our own borders in the last year to look at extreme flooding, fires, you know, weather records being broken and extremely costly, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars, record-breaking in terms of cost and not to mention human cost and jobs and livelihoods and towns being leveled, you know, with record storms. Isn't that exactly what climate scientists had predicted, and why are those dots not being connected in the face of this?
It is exactly what is predicted to happen more frequently and more severely, and as you're pointing out, Betsy, it is in fact happening. This past year has really been a whole series of tragedies of the exact type that have been predicted, and unfortunately the predictions are that we will continue to have more and worse of the same. But to your point of isn't anybody connecting the dots, I would have to answer that question no. I mean, yes, people like yourself are trying to connect the dots, but by and large, the media is not covering this issue, the issue of climate change, very aggressively right now. The last time the media the news media was seriously focused on the issue of climate change was several years ago. The news coverage over the past several years since the period in which all the nations of the world were trying to negotiate a climate treaty in Copenhagen in 2009, news coverage has just plummeted since then. And so the question of who's connecting the dots, well, it really isn't the news media in any systematic way. earlier this year, there has been a bit of coverage on a number of major national magazines and newspapers looking, trying to connect the dots. But again, that was a bit of a blip. So the news media has moved on. This really isn't part of the public dialogue. At least the news media isn't keeping it as part of the public dialogue. So, I wish the dots were being connected a little bit more effectively, but I don't think the news media is doing that.
They're not, the mainstream news media. The problem is that those of us in progressive media are doing it on the Internet and blogs, and yet we don't have the profile, the platform that they have, and that's what I think needs to change, because I've for 15 years been interviewing experts like yourself on these issues, and it's getting a little old and a little tiresome trying to, you know, get mainstream media to cover it. I think people who are covering it should get some support, especially given what we're up against with Fox. And I know that may sound self-serving, but that's really not my motivation. I'm really just trying to say, why don't entities that are reporting on the facts, are connecting the dots, why don't they get, you know, the same funding that the conservative right wing does? And that's perhaps a question for someone else, but if you have any thoughts, please share them, because that's where I've been living for too long now, and it's deeply frustrating.
Yeah, I'd actually like to offer a slightly different perspective, and that is,
please,
when we do our surveys, we ask people how much do they trust various sources of information about global warming. So we ask them about scientists, for example, and scientists are the most trusted sources. We ask them about TV weathercasters. They are the second most trusted source of information. We ask them about the news media, much less trusted than weathercasters. So, you know, on one hand, I do lament the lack of sustained appropriate coverage in the news media. On the other hand, I have to say I'm a little bit, it takes me to thinking about, well, what can we do to activate some of these other voices, the science voices, the voices in the science community, the voices in the weathercaster community, and a group of people that I know very well, because actually my primary training is in the field of public health. And over the past year, I've been working very closely with other members of the public health community to encourage them and to enable them to start explaining in simple, clear ways that public health people are known to communicate that climate change isn't just a plants, penguins, and polar bears problem. It's, in fact, a people problem. Some Americans care deeply about plants, penguins, and polar bears. We all care deeply about people. And the fact that we've done a relatively poor job of explaining the human dimensions of climate change is both a problem and an opportunity. It's an opportunity for my public health colleagues to step in and use the credibility that they've earned in their communities to say, hey, you know, actually the climate is changing, not only worldwide, but right here in our community. We did a survey of public health department directors a couple of years ago, and over 60% of them, 60% of the public health department directors in America told us that they were already seeing health harm, health impacts in their community that they were convinced was a result of the changing global climate. So that means there's a lot of public health professionals in communities around America who see that we have a problem and who occupy a very special niche in communities and can use that niche, that podium, to educate their citizens about the nature of the threat. And here's the really beautiful part of it. They also have an opportunity to educate their citizens about the immediate benefits to our health in a variety of ways if we respond to climate change. So, for example, even members of the dismissive segment, the group that we talked about earlier, who doesn't believe in global warming at all, they do actually believe that burning dirty fuel isn't a good idea, and they believe that if we can move ourselves away from burning dirty fuel, we'll help to clean our air and our water, and if we can clean our air and our water, we will all live more healthfully. Our children who have asthma, our parents, who some of whom have, you know, serious chronic diseases that make it difficult for them to breathe and move around. So this confluence of dirty fuel leads to dirty air, dirty water, which leads to ill health, is something that we all Americans agree about. And public health professionals are in a really, really good place to make that point that, hey, let's move beyond the sort of the bickering about global warming and let's move towards solutions that improve our lives in a number of different important ways.
And again, you know, having covered this green beat for so many years and having had so many friends say, you know, I agree, it's important, it's great to see your passion, Betsy, but people won't pay attention till there's really a crisis. And look how many, you know, weather crises we've had just, again, in the last year or two around the country, around the world. So I really have to question, you know, what will it take? Because, you know, it's hard to imagine, you know, what has happened in terms of, you know, almost weekly there's some extreme weather event. And we're talking about during the spring, during the summer, and hurricane season now. Hurricanes in New York and New Jersey, you know, Springfield, Massachusetts. I don't know, you know, what kind of emergency we need. I mean, look at what happened in Japan. If we need an example of how, you know, human error does happen and worst-case scenarios do happen and our energy sources and what we rely on for our energy needs are so, you know, vulnerable. And you know, it's hard to imagine a more perfect storm than the events we've had. And then just going back, you know, the last 2 years with the BP oil spill, with the coal mine explosion, and let's see, the Japan, that was like a perfect storm of, you know, really scary events. I mean, don't you think things are getting pretty scary? Just look at the weather. I just don't know how people ignore that.
And the trends are really clear. You look at the data going back a number of decades in you know, the U.S. at large and every single region of the U.S., and the data are there to prove your point, Betsy. The weather is getting worse. The weather is getting more violent, more extreme, fundamentally less reliable in providing for the needs that we have as human and other non-human communities. I spend a lot of my time actually working with the community of weathercasters around the country, and I'm interested in helping them to embrace the role of climate educator. And what we've seen over the past 2 years is that this was a fairly new idea for them, somewhat of an intimidating idea, because it's becoming a climate educator requires a weathercaster to sort of step out beyond his or her comfort zone. And they're still learning to do that. But what we have found, we've met a couple of dozen, what we call early adopters around the country, people who have already embraced this role very actively, bringing an enormous amount of passion to it. In Columbia, South Carolina, the senior meteorologist at WLTX, CBS News affiliate in Columbia, South Carolina. He has been doing this with his viewers for quite a number of years now, and we actually just completed a survey of his viewers and other viewers of competing stations in Columbia. And what we've shown is that his viewers actually do hold more science-based views about climate change because of Jim Gandy's efforts to educate his viewers. So we think weathercasters are going to play a really important positive role in educating Americans about this issue going forward, but it's, you know, it's not a role that they're all going to embrace or they're all going be will be able to embrace overnight. It takes time to change what you do.
Right, and what I've been pushing for is just, you know, once a week or once a day, you know, just 1 hour with all the outlets we've got and all the reality shows and cable TV and satellite radio. There's actually not any program out there other than Living on Earth on NPR, and that's not live call-in interactive, you know, daily. It's a weekend show. It's great, but it just blows my mind that there's still not one green talk show out there, given the planet is imperiled, and that's what I lose sleep over. And just it's just you know. But what I've learned is it's not just a matter of, you know, getting the information out there and people finally, you know, getting the science. There's active forces out there, Koch brothers, you know, trying to keep, you know, this kind of message and media off the air. I've experienced it personally, professionally. How dark is that? And it's kind of left me so, you know, frustrated. I just launched America's Green Tea Party for a healthier alternative. For those of us who are steamed, they're playing politics with the planet. I mean, I don't know what else to do with what I know other than, you know, stop sleeping, implode or commit a crime, because some of us are actually so worked up about this that it's continuing, and okay. Have children and look them in the eyes and want to help, and we can't. We're blocked against these dark forces that are really very persistent, very powerful.
May I tell a quick story? Because I fear our time is almost up, and I'd love to tell the story in response
Please.
To what you just said.
Please.
And I'm not an expert on U.S. Civil War history, but I read this in the New York Times Magazine, Sunday Magazine, about a couple of months ago, and it was a story of a Union general newly appointed to his post, and he something quite unexpected happened within his first day on the job, and that was three runaway slaves presented themselves at the fort, and they asked for sanctuary. And the general spoke to them and asked them, you know, asked them to tell their stories, and they explained who they were and that they had run away and that they felt that that the North should provide them with sanctuary. And the general did temporarily provide them with sanctuary, but he actually wrote President Lincoln to request clarifications. What are his orders? The president and the cabinet actually decided not to respond. They thought this was quite an interesting situation. They thought the newly appointed general seemed to be in a pretty good position to make his own decisions, and so he did offer them sanctuary. Very, very quickly, word of that act spread among the enslaved population in the South, at least in the region of this fort, and within days or weeks, I'm not exactly sure of the exact time period, but a very short period of time, approximately 500 more slaves escaped and requested sanctuary, which was granted. And this created apparently sort of a firestorm in the American news media. A new term was even coined in response to describe these people. They were called contrabands. And then the public dialogue that emerged about these contrabands, these 500 escaped slaves who were now at least temporarily being offered sanctuary, apparently had a really positive catalytic quality in terms of advancing our public will in the North to embrace abolition. So while our president at the time was still working out his own views, something happened, something totally unexpected, literally, in a single day that sparked a whole series of related events, all of which catalyzed public will that it's now time for us to do the right thing. So I tell the story only because I hear a certain amount of despair or desperation in your voice. Mm-hmm. And I choose to actually read my own research findings, this public opinion data that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. I interpret it somewhat optimistically. I see that there's a real wellspring of support for government action, local, state, and federal government action. It hasn't happened yet. As you said, there's a number of forces that are, doing their best to oppose it. But I think the American people are almost there. They're ready to be catalyzed into making up their mind that it's time for us to do the right thing. And what exactly that is remains to be seen, but that is precisely the debate America needs to be having. How should we best respond to this? Not the silly debate that we've been having, which is, should we respond to this?
Silly pseudo-debate. And hopefully President Obama will rise to the occasion now that we've got health care and debt ceilings and budgets out of the way to really turn attention, as a leader, because I do think he understands these pressing environmental challenges are real, for him to stand up and have a state, as some friends are talking about, floating the idea of a state of the climate, speech. Why not? I mean, it impacts everything, every person on the planet, and America's got a, unusually large footprint, so we're a big part of the problem, and if we don't deal with it, from the top down, I think it's not going to happen. We'll be stuck in this ridiculous, nightmarish impasse. But thanks for your encouraging words, and I don't mean to sound so negative. It's just this has been going on for too long as far as I'm concerned, especially as we see the ravages of climate change, and especially because the CO2 out in the atmosphere, even if we stopped spewing it today, and we're not, is going to be there for a long time. So I guess that's what keeps me up at night. But I look for any encouraging news. So thank you for sharing that with us, and thank you for sharing your time.
Thank you for having me.
And your great work. I've been speaking with Ed Maybach. He is with the George Mason Center for Climate Change Communication, with over a quarter century experience as a public health communication and social marketing researcher. And they are focused exclusively there on how the public is engaging or not on climate change reality, mitigation, and adaptation. So a real great resource, and I hope to have them back on the Green Front, or perhaps a show maybe back on a mainstream media platform, as well as the wonderful Progressive Radio Network. So thanks again, Ed. And we're going to take a short break. I'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. You're listening to Green Front Radio. Welcome back to the Green Front. I'm here. We need to get someone from the solar industry on to talk about this Solyndra story that just won't go away. If you believe the extreme conservative Republicans, the dinosaur camps, this signals the death of the solar industry. The fact that Solyndra declared bankruptcy, it must surely be a sign of things to come, and they could not be more wrong. Got a glimpse of what's going on inside the industry from the Solar Industry Association. They just had a teleconference yesterday talking about how the industry is, in fact, growing. There are some 100,000 jobs in this country, over 1,000 solar companies. The prices are coming down. The technology is improving, and in fact, if you have done any research into Solyndra and what caused it to fail, it really was changing market conditions. It has to do with China being able to manufacture solar panels at a cheaper rate than they can in this country. Also, Solyndra had a non-silicon technology in their products, so it really had nothing to do with the fact that solar industry is in trouble. Of course, funding for clean tech, like funding for everything, has been challenged by this economy, but don't believe it for a minute that solar is on its way out, au contraire, and it's just so maddening to hear this constant. It's like the climate gate, right? They're going to use that and milk that for as long as they can to be a sign that Al Gore, you know, is an idiot, and we tree huggers are just misguided and mocking all of this, and that's just crazy. And by the way, the Wall Street Journal, owned by one Rupert Murdoch, just last year called Solyndra a top clean tech company, and of course now they're all over the Department of Energy for making the loan back in 2009. I mean, isn't that convenient? I guess they're hoping everybody has the attention span of a gnat and not going to look more closely at what's actually happening. They ranked Solyndra number 5 of the top 50 venture-backed companies in a survey to gauge the odds of success for U.S.-based companies valued at less than $1 billion. So changing of some thinking there, how convenient is that? Also, and so we hope to get someone from the Solar Industry Association on the show next week. He was supposed to be with us, but at the last minute he got called away to something else. So we will have hopefully have Rome Resch with us, and you'll hear more about that from his research that is very encouraging. Want to bring you some good news whenever we can. On the negative front, looking at Joseph Rome's climate blog, climateprogress.org, because that is the best resource out there. There are some good ones, but he's the one that always has the very latest. He has a post about the Desires fantasy world, the EIA projecting a 40% rise in CO2 emissions by 2035. The EIA, of course, is the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and just this week they issued their International Energy Outlook, and they're saying that things are, in fact, quite dire. We have uncontrolled carbon emissions on the rise, as we expected, and that, of course, is the primary heat-trapping gas fueling climate change, and the picture is not good. It says that carbon dioxide emissions are going to continue to rise some 40% between now and 2035. And as you may also know, we are supposed to be at the safe level for parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. It's, of course, 350. That's where Bill McKibben got his name for 350.org. We're up to, I think, almost 390 parts per million. So we're going unchecked in the wrong direction. And that's why it's so maddening that we're continuing to have so much attention focused on, you know, whether or not we have a problem with climate change, whether or not we humans are causing it, rather than getting the whole country, like much of the rest of the world, frankly, on board to recognize that this is the mother of all challenges, the great exacerbator. You know, we talk about climate change has so many impacts, not the least of which is ocean acidification. And I just saw a fabulous movie, by the way. I highly recommend it if you have a chance to see a nice film called A Sea Change. Not nice in terms of its message, because the seas are a-changing, and it's not good. But it it follows a grandfather, a history professor, who is very concerned about where the future is going. His young grandson starts asking him, very precocious, bright grandson, starts asking him questions about what's happening with global warming and what is it and what's going on with the ocean. So he set out, the grandfather, to go back to his native Norway and up to the Arctic and do some research, and found that it's, in fact, quite grim, that we are already seeing, you know, the shellfish in the sea. Their shells are beginning to break down because of warmer oceans, more acidification in the oceans, as we're seeing with the coral bleaching, coral reef bleaching. And he had a sad tale to come back and relate to his grandson. But it's still a sweet story. So I recommend it if anyone has a chance to see that. So what are we doing about these problems? We're still discussing and debating. We're not in every corner, of course, but I guess my world is media, and that's what I track. That's what my focus is, having been a broadcast journalist for some more years than I want to mention, 25 years now, covering the environmental stories for about 15 years, and just never, ever, ever could have dreamed that we would see this kind of obfuscation and direct calculated lies that are coming out of corners that have huge followings. Don't underestimate Fox's audience on television and radio. It's outrageous. And they're still saying in the face of all this that we don't have a problem. Of course, Michelle Bachmann, one of the presidential candidates, and the Republican Party would have us believe we should abolish the EPA, that they've either done no good or they've solved all the problems. I don't even think they give them credit for that. They just say they're just spending money, just another, you know, over-bloated regulatory agency. How outrageous is that when our environment is under siege on every possible front, with species dying, oceans being overfished and warming, and carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, messing with the very delicate balance our ecosystems that make life possible. And as species are having to go, you know, to higher ground and are disappearing, and that's impacting the food chain, it's something that, you know, how dare we humans mess with this? And then, you know, even worse than that, a bigger crime, now that we know what we know and know what we're probably doing, not address it. And anyone who actively turns that tide, you know, around, I think, should be offset. I've been trying to get Sean Hannity off the set, because he happens to be one who continually mocks any kind of climate expert or climate scientist or environmentalist. And of course, his sidekick, Chris Horner. If you'd like to see what I'm talking about, just YouTube my name, Betsy Rosenberg, on YouTube, and you'll see all my encounters with them. And I only watch it when I go on the show, but I go on because, no, not because I like to get beat up. I like to think I got a few licks in, but because who else is going to try to get the truth out? You know, they do have occasional, you know, green folks on, and they try to beat us up, but the facts are on our side. So I just know that, you know, judgment will prevail, and intelligence will prevail, and judgment will finally, you know, see that the facts were on our side. So they're on the wrong side, and they're mocking us, but, you know, I think they should look in the mirror and ask themselves how they sleep at night, really, instead of us being up at night. So that about does it for this edition of The Green Front. I just want to send you to a couple of my favorite places, climateprogress.org. Think Progress is a wonderful resource. The Daily Climate also captures all the climate stories from around the globe, both in press and print and also broadcast media. And, of course, thegreenfront.com has all of my shows archived. If you'd like to go back and see the work I've done over the years, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews with green leaders, eco-innovators, can be found at ecotalk.net, and encourage you to also check out our website coming soon, greenteaparties.com. We'll have that up hopefully in the next few weeks to talk about what some of us are doing in terms of gathering and house parties, and talking about how we do believe that environmental issues should not be overlooked, are critically important, and to really, you know, congregate a coalition of voices and to say, you know, loudly from a platform, united platform, we know the truth. We are not okay with you leaders, supposed leaders, ignoring this issue. It will not go away, and we must address it. And we are mothers. We are mostly women, but certainly welcome all men into the America's Green Tea Party. We are all concerned Americans. We are all political stripes. We are nonpartisan, because it is insane and suicide, in fact, eco-suicide, to be playing politics with our one and only planet that serves us so well. And, you know, we are part of nature, guys. Accept it. Get over it. That does it for this edition. I want to thank Matt Bogart, back in the studio, Progressive Radio Network, winging it with me for another hour of the program. I like to get you the latest interviews and topics, and sometimes we succeed, and sometimes, like today, we get a cancellation, but I hope you haven't minded going a little bit long with Ed Maybach. He really is one of the experts on climate change science, and a little bit of commentary on my part. But until next time, please check us out at thegreenfront.com.